Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Andreas Roos. He's a researcher and activist working to understand, expose, and challenge the environmentally destructive logic of industrial technologies. He recently defended his dissertation in the field of human ecology at Lund University, Sweden, entitled Renewing Power, Including Global Asymmetries Within the System Boundaries of Photovoltaic Technology. The book deals with the mismatch between the conventional expectations of solar technology and the not-so-promising ecological reality of massively increasing the world's solar capacity. He's also done research on the promises and perils of information and communications technologies and compared energy flows in industrial versus non-industrial food systems. First off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much. Thanks, you.
So there's a sentence that I just read that I think is really extraordinary. And in fact, I think your entire dissertation is extraordinary and people should read it. Excuse me. Again, it's called Renewing Power, Including Global Asymmetries Within the System Boundaries of Solar Photovoltaic Technology. And you said the book deals with the mismatch between the conventional expectations of solar technology and the not so promising ecological reality of massively increasing the world's solar capacity. What do you mean by that?
Well, first off, I think it's important to acknowledge and realize that there is a big faith in solar technology in modern societies and in industrial culture. And this is what I call a solar vision, basically. That we live with essentially. And it's solar power. If you look at any textbook, at least, so wind back. At least when I was a student in human ecology, and I read these books by, for instance, Miller and Spoolman, this Living in Environment and these classic textbooks on ecology. We all learn about the problems of the loss of biodiversity, the impacts of climate change, the detrimental effects of pollution and eutrophication, etc. And then by the end of the books, almost all of them ends with this kind of hopeful note on renewables. So somehow all these problems will be solved with the help of further technology that originally generated these problems. Well, solar power may not have generated all of these problems, but all of the problems had something to do with the proliferation of modern industrial technology. And in particular, solar power. Well, so when I wrote this thesis, I was considering writing about all renewables. But I chose solar power because there is this, and I can't necessarily explain why, but there is a fascination for directly capturing the direct solar energy. And you can see, for instance, there is this proposal, or there was this proposal in this textbook that I mentioned, the ecological textbook, where they say that we should increase solar power 700-fold, and which was more than other renewables. So there is an expectation on that renewables, and in solar power in particular, will solve the questions we're facing. So that is the vision, essentially. And there are a lot of course, arguments, some legitimate, like, for instance, solar power generates less CO2 emissions in the usage phase, for instance, than fossil fuels. So they are preferable in some aspects. But it's important to realize that these technologies do not come from nowhere. That's what I try to stress in this thesis. Because when we talk about solar power, there is a tendency and any technology for that matter, there is a tendency to omit the fact that they have actually been produced in the world. And this is, in a way, the reality. Every technology is produced. But in the way we speak about technology, that is typically not recognized. So in the thesis, I look at these visions and, for instance, how solar power can inaugurate new social and ecological relations, but find that all of these, or most of these visions tend to just simply ignore that solar power and solar photovoltaic technology in particular is actually being produced. And if we recognize that solar power is being produced, that it has a past before appearing to us in the present as artifacts or objects, then some of these visions become very, very contradictory. So, for instance, we could say that, Naomi Klein has got these arguments that, you know, we can install solar power in our local communities in order to create a situation where we ourselves organize to produce our own energy, essentially. But what is omitted from that picture is the fact that solar panels don't simply appear from nowhere. Solar panels are produced in a highly complex world economy. And they involve all kinds of chains in the supply chain. So everything from mining of the raw materials and metals and silicone, the quartz, and silver, zinc, all kinds of metals, rare earth minerals, which have an impact upon the natural world and upon the systems and social systems, the social conditions of the people living there. And so if we think that installing solar power in our local communities will somehow inaugurate a just world, an ecologically sustainable world, that vision is contingent. It depends on us omitting this whole production chain. And that's the repeated thing that occurs in these visions, this omission, essentially. So that was a long answer. But that's what that's the mismatch that I have found. And then I go in when this is, of course, a theme in much of the ecological critique of renewable energy. So in that sense, it's nothing new. But I dwell into this issue, you might say, in the thesis, and look at whether this mismatch is actually necessary for solar power to exist in its industrial variety.
What do you mean by the last thing you said? You look into whether this mismatch is necessary. Can you be really specific on what mismatch and what you mean by necessary?
Okay. So the mismatch is that our visions, our understanding of solar power does not align to the reality of it. And
you've hit that. I really like what you've said about that so far. And what do you mean by necessary?
Necessary
for what? Necessary in order to get the environmental movement to support the solar panels, or necessary for governments to support it, or am I missing your point entirely?
No, necessary for it to appear as a viable option you might say. Yeah, as for it to appear sustainable, you might say.
Okay, so can you, I think, I really like what you're saying, and this is something that has confounded me and confused me for a long time too, is that you have a lot of people who are explicitly like anti-colonial, and they talk about being against empire, and they talk about being sustainable, all three of those things, but you know, the raw materials will come from Indonesia or from China or from a rural area. So I mean, it ends up being still colonialism. I'm just agreeing with you and saying that this confuses me too. So can you go into some of the specifics in the chain of supply? Let's move for the next little bit in the interview from, let's start with the problems with attaining raw materials through the production and then through land use, because you have one chapter called Calculating the Necessary Land for the Solar Aspirations of China, Germany, India, and Italy. So can we just move from beginning to end over the next little bit from mining materials through land use for it to getting rid of the waste materials?
Sure. I haven't got into waste material that much, but we can do that. And I think to start off, I think it's first of all very important to recognize how complex these supply chains are. I have one image in the thesis, which is from a German company called Nagel Ite, which produces one single commodity. And I'll just mention it because it's relevant in this context. And it's a computer mouse. It's one of those computer mouse with a cord. It just looks completely ordinary computer mouse. And the whole company idea is to be able to track each of the material components down to the metals in the world and where they come from, and document whether or not these chains, these materials that are produced for the mouse, are produced under fair conditions or not. And they have this great PDF illustration, essentially, where they display it as boxes that are either red or green. And if they're green, they know about the working conditions and they're fair, etc. If they're red, they don't know anything about it. And when you look at that picture, there are 140, or actually 139 chains, boxes, for one single computer mouse. So to produce something as seemingly simple as a little computer mouse, there are over 100 steps involved in its production. And so I think we should bear this in mind first and foremost when we talk about.
I'm looking at the chart right now. And do you mean 100 steps, or do you mean 100 materials?
Well, so there are 100 different processes, I would say. Okay. So there are roughly, I don't know how many materials, 20 to 30 materials maybe.
Okay.
And then these are processed in many, many different steps to finally arrive at the computer mouse. Yeah. So it's notoriously difficult to trace all of the material components in a solar panel, but we know about the and it's relatively easy to find the most obvious material components of it, such as quartz and polysilicone, that is making up the most obvious part of the solar module or solar panel. So,
By the way, as we speak right now, as we're doing this interview, there is a terrible fire going on at a polysilicon plant in China.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, yeah. I just read about it today.
Wow. Do you know where it is?
Was
it reported in? Do you know where it was reported?
Okay, I know this is really rude, but keep talking, and I'll look it up and tell you in a second.
Okay, sure. Yeah, and I think you in your book, you go through these steps of the supply chain in a way better than I do. But what I look at is the total carbon footprint and ecological footprint, not only carbon footprint, of the entire commodity chain of solar panels. So I, in a way, do a shortcut where I don't go into the polysilicon production and then estimate the land necessary for that alone. But I take money as a measure. So the money that these solar modules, the costs of them essentially, and I translate that costs into land, which is a method I use in chapter 5, which I don't think I will explain it now, but it's a two-step method that is connected to work in ecological economics, where you first, maybe I should just say very, very briefly how I do that.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. Let's see. So for the first step essentially is to convert money to energy. And we know there's ecological economics who work with these issues. They know there's a very close link between a country's energy use or energy dissipation, you might say, because energy cannot actually be used up. And it's GDP. So if GDP goes up, you can be pretty sure that the energy expenditure will follow the exact same curve. If it goes down, you could expect the energy usage is going down as well. And of course, in physics, all verbs essentially requires energy. So every economic activity is energy that is being dissipated or transformed or used, if you will. So there's a very close relation between GDP, money, and energy use in that sense. The second step is to convert this energy use, if money is a representative of energy, to land. And here the best way is to go through the carbon footprint, which is what I did. Where a certain amount of energy, fossil energy in particular, is connected to a particular ecological footprint. So we can derive a land estimate from that, which includes also the sequestration of the carbon through reforestation. There are all kinds of questions we can go into here, but I'll just leave it at that. So I do a shortcut for these this commodity chain here and arrive at how much land essentially a solar panel requires and how much energy it requires in order to exist, you might say, in order to be produced. And if we include the entire commodity chain, if you look at a solar panel as an object, you can see that, you know, there's a certain amount of area that it covers to capture the sun. And the area that is necessary apart from this immediate surface area that you see is up to or higher than 100 times more of that. So
if you have a solar panel that is, just for the sake of ease, is 1 meter by 1 meter, then that means that that actually harmed land that was 100 square meters.
Yes, exactly. More than that. But these calculations are also, they're not extremely accurate. But more, 100 is we can say with relative certainty. But more, I would say. I got actually, my figures point to 80 to 160 times. But just to be on the safe side, I say 100.
And you mentioned energy. Do you want to talk about what you were talking about more, or do you want, I would love if you would introduce EROI and talk about the EROI of solar as well. But do you want to talk more about what you're doing before you go there, or do you want to jump into EROI?
I think I can explain one more thing about this with land and then how it's relevant for our understanding of solar power as authoritarian.
Okay, great, please.
And then I can jump into EROI or EROI. So if this is true, that solar panels actually necessitate this amount of land, then the question, in a sense, becomes, okay, so if we have these local communities, and or a nation for that matter, and we have an aspiration, a vision to transform our current way of living with the energy consumption, I'm talking about we in the industrial nations, Western world, transform our high energy way of living from fossil fuels to these solar panels, for instance, or other renewables. What would that demand of the natural world? And could you, as a local community, even feasibly have the whole production chain within your local community? Would it even be possible? Would there be enough space, essentially, to kind of compress this whole commodity chain, just in theory?
Wait, you're not even suggesting that they have to have all the raw materials there, which will never happen, because you're not going to have, I don't know, silver everywhere. You're not going to have copper everywhere. You're not going to have the right quality of quartz everywhere. So you're just saying land. You're not saying specific materials, right?
Yeah, in this case, yes. So this is a thought experiment, you might say.
Okay. Yeah. Because of course, if you have to include the specific raw materials, then it's even more absurd.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole idea of locally producing energy with solar power is if you look at it this way, it's ridiculous. Like no local area has got all these materials in one particular place. So it's not a matter of producing and like solar. That's the thing as well. The whole production chain is often omitted in the way we talk about solar power. So when we say local energy production, we're not including the whole commodity chain of the solar modules. That would be unfeasible to begin with, because we don't have all the materials in one place. Yeah.
But I interrupted you when you were saying about land.
Yeah. So even if we have, say, a country that has this is what I go into in chapter 5. Even if we have a country such as Germany, for instance, who has had and has high-flying visions of a solar-powered future, renewables-powered future, would there be enough land to accommodate this whole production process without compromising too much, you might say, or anything for now, well, it would compromise local environments for sure, but how much? What I find is that if you, so that would obviously depend on the vision and how much energy you would expect to produce. And what I find, along with other researchers in this area, is that sometimes these visions would demand more surface area than the entire country can provide, which means, and what I claim in the thesis is that this does not necessarily mean that solar power is impossible for countries such as Germany, even if it has this massive ecological footprint. But it means that if you can outsource this land requirement, then you can have solar power as a feasible, you might say, at least locally, option for your country or your local community. So that's where I claim that these visions and solar PV, large-scale solar PV projects are inherently political in the sense that they would be very unattractive if you would not outsource the impacts of them. And that's what also makes them authoritarian in Mumford's sense, that they require, in a sense, global asymmetries or asymmetries between people, and that is what I found in the thesis overall, you might say. So that's a in a way a short summary there. And the same goes for energy. So there's this measure on EROI, which stands for energy return on energy invested. Sometimes it's abbreviated EROE. Let's see, EROI. So it's energy return on energy invested. Sorry, did you want to say something before I jump into this?
Oh, I was just going to read something from your thesis.
Sure.
Which is saying exactly what you're saying. These findings imply that Germany's solar aspirations would probably imply high economic costs if the energy, land, and labor had to be supplied domestically. The possibility can be tested by calculating the cost of solar PV modules based on German wages and energy prices. And in the 2018, China exported solar PV modules to Germany at a total exchange value of $463 million, and there were X amount of labor, and you just go through, and if they were paid German wages instead of Chinese wages, it would have been $1.4 million. And then embodied energy, you go through the same thing there. It's just, again, a lot of the people who promote this also claim to be for social justice, but it's based on, as you said, unfair labor practices.
Right. And very different forms of environmental regulations, if you compare Germany to China, for instance. Yeah.
Oh, exactly. One of the reasons that the prices are so much cheaper in China is because they don't have the regulations for what to do with the waste materials.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that this is what is completely missed when people are praising the low costs of solar panels. I go through some of the explanations of why we see the reduction in price on solar panels and the kind of drastic drop over the last 10, 15 years. And there are a lot of people thinking that it's because of increased, that we just become better at producing them, in the sense that we have increased our scientific knowledge of the photovoltaic process and engineering practices, but completely missed this point that the production has been moved from North America and Europe to Asia, where there are much lower wages and less environmental regulations, which is why also we see this these massive impacts of the solar industry and pollution of rivers, the essentially killing of landscapes, and these other reports that we get. And now more recently, I think just a few days before my defense, there was this reports from the Guardian on the that the Uyghurs, so this ethnic minority and people in the northwest of China in the Xinjiang province are basically who are basically shuttled into these labor camps are actually the workers in the for the solar modules. And there was this I don't know, headline where it was I can't remember the headline now, but this a scandal that 40% of the UK of UK's solar panels were produced by these Uyghurs. And so it's not about increased knowledge of this photovoltaic process. That has reduced these prices. It's not that they become more efficient and therefore cheaper, etc. It's because essentially it's easier, or they've learned these corporations to exploit, and governments for that matter, people and environments by moving production facilities. And what we see in turn as well is that production facilities are also moving from China to Southeast Asia now, so to Malaysia, Vietnam, and other places. So these production facilities move around where the environmental regulations are low and where the labor is cheap. That's what transnational corporations do. That's their, in a way, one of the roots of their power, you might say.
So three things. One of them is that one of the things I love about your thesis and about this conversation is I really love this sort of analysis and this sort of honesty and just sort of a hard look at, and it doesn't matter whether we're talking about solar photovoltaics or where your dinner came from or anything else. I love this sort of precise analysis. So I just want to really thank you for that. Second thing is, I said earlier I was going to look up the massive fire. You said, where is it? And I'm not going to be able to pronounce this, but it's Shihezi City in Xinjiang in China.
Okay. Can you say the last one?
Xinjiang. Xinjiang?
Xinjiang, yeah, that's the province I was talking about with the Uyghurs, I suspect. Xinjiang, yeah.
It's a big explosion happened, a massive fire and explosion at a polysilicon chemical plant in that city, in that province.
Mm.
June 8th around noon.
Okay.
Anyway, so third thing, now that I've interrupted you so many times, do you want to talk about EROEI?
I can briefly mention it,
its relation to solar.
Yeah. So EROI stands for the energy return on energy investment. So it's different it's a concept that's used by ecological economists, which is the field I'm drawing upon in this thesis, apart from philosophy of technology. And essentially it is. Okay, so for any organism to survive in nature, you need to acquire energy in some way or another, one way or another. And for most species, that is simply eating food, so hunting, gathering food, the food that you need, foraging. And the same applies to humans and human societies. We need food, and we also need, or we don't necessarily need, but we often make use of energy, even if it's not food. So for heating our homes, for instance. But all of these strategies to get energy requires energy as well. So say oil, just take an example like oil. There needs to be an actual excavation and production of oil to receive oil. In that way, you use energy in order to get energy. And the EROI of, so energy return on energy investment is the ratio between how much you use and how much you get from a particular energy strategy, you might say, or energy technology. So as an example, the early oil fields in the Spindletop, for instance, in, I think, Texas. I can't exactly remember. But the energy return on energy investment was extremely high. You basically drilled down a few meters. And, you know, these classic images of oil just spewing up. And there's like this oil rain. I don't know how much that is cartoon and how much that is reality. But you essentially drilled a hole, which didn't require that much energy to do, to get a massive amount of energy. So the EROI of early oil, you might say, early conventional oil, was extremely high. So something in the lines of, for one unit of energy, you got maybe 100 units back or more. And you can apply this to all kinds of energy strategies. You can apply it to hunter-gathering, how much energy is hunter-gatherers in certain areas using versus how much they get back from that practice. And one of the, yeah. So the same applies to solar panels, of course, that you need to use energy. You need to manufacture solar panels in order for solar panels to be installed. Actually generating or harnessing the energy. And the EROI of solar panels is disputed, you might say, because there are and other energy technologies too, for that matter, but especially solar power and biomass are disputed because there's this conversation of what should you actually include in the production process. And in the thesis, what I do is that I show that the more we include, the wider we draw the boundaries of what a solar panel is. So if we include the entire commodity chain, like I talked about before, then we get a very non-favorable view from an energy point of view.
Before we go any further, what would be an argument for not being inclusive? Why would you not include all of the energy inputs?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Yeah.
I mean, because if you're going to do the analysis, you may as well do the analysis.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. One reason that I found is that some researchers claim that this is not interesting for policymakers because, and I don't know why.
Just to be clear, let's say some place is going to mine 100 tons of quartz, and that's going to cost a certain amount of units. Well, I understand that if some of that quartz goes into, I don't know, windows or some other use, then obviously you don't count that in the solar panels. No. But if 20% of the quartz goes into solar panels, then you can count 20% of the energy that went into mining the quartz.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that just makes sense. I mean, I don't know why you would exclude anything. Sorry that my voice is getting thin and reedy and I'm getting defensive, but this is annoying.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think But this is where it's at in a way. My claim is that these narrow boundaries, where they don't include the parts of the production chain at all. Okay, so one of the arguments that I know now is that some researchers, not all, want to have a clearly defined boundary so you can compare different energy technologies, say, like, yeah, so kind of to systemize it somehow. Because if you include the entire production chain, it becomes more messy in a way, but it also becomes more representative of reality. And that's what my claim, at least, is in this chapter, that if we include more of the entire production chain, if we don't do that, we won't get a complete picture of what solar power is and what it does and what it requires.
Okay, so
is not interesting for everyone. These other people who simply wants to compare it to solar power, compare solar power to fossil fuels, and be able to say, let's do solar power instead of fossil fuels. That's like, there's this research that it kind of just wants to compare with fossil fuels, and then to be able to say, let's go with solar power, kind of. Yeah.
Okay, I just thought of an argument for why you should set a boundary. That let's say you are mining the 100 tons of quartz, and obviously it takes more than 100 tons. You do 100 tons at some mine. So do you then have to include the trucks that are used in mining? Do you have to include all of those? And what if they bought a used truck? How do you prorate that? So I do see how it could get complicated.
Mm. Yeah, right. And how much energy is used in the production of that truck in turn?
Right. And like I said, if it's a used truck you buy, how much of it do you have to count in the solar, and how much of it for its previous job as a dump truck?
Yeah. Yeah, it involves a lot of assumptions. But you can also, yeah. You can also get pretty fair estimations of how much energy would be required. It all depends on the assumptions you're making. Actually go to a place and track the whole thing, which is, again, immensely complex.
Well, and then how much of the food for the miners do you count? I mean, I can see how it could get impossibly complex in an impossibly complex world. Okay, so now that I've muddied all those waters, can you sort of give us the bottom line on EROI for solar?
Yeah. Okay. So before I do that, let me just give you a brief idea of what the actual numbers mean. So there's something called the net energy cliff, which explains how a higher EROI relates to the percentage of, okay, no, so this becomes more way too technical, I think. Let's just say, like, an EROI up until 10. So if you use one unit of energy, you get 10 units back. That's quite favorable for society, or quite unfavorable to society. And then when it gets higher than 10, it's a decent energy strategy for sustaining advanced industrial societies, you might say. And this, of course, doesn't take account into the qualitative difference between electricity and fuels and etc. For example, an EROI of 2 would demand that 50% of society's energy is dedicated entirely to this energy strategy. So if you have a solar power and the EROI is 2 to 1, so you use one unit of energy and you get 2 units back, that means that 50% of society's whole effort, all energy use, would be used for the production of solar panels. So that's a massive amount of energy. And then I have 3 different boundaries, and the conventional boundary, EROI standard, that gets the figure of 7.7 to 38, so almost up to 40 EROY, which means that if we exclude a lot of the production process, these solar panels appear as very energy favorable. The conclusion would be yes, we can sustain in that advanced industrial societies on these technologies. There's a middle boundary that ends at roughly 4, which includes also, like we talked before, includes more of these the energy. And I go into exactly what these boundaries are more in detail in the thesis. And then we have the EROY extended, where I try to include, this is what I do here, I try to include the entire production process as much as I can. And I end up with an EROY of 0.8 to a maximum of 4 for solar power. So for an EROY of 4, if I'm generous, that would mean that any society that wants to sustain on 100% solar power, just as a thought experiment now, there's actually no such society, but there is efforts to push for 100% renewables. But 4 would require at least 30 to 40% of society's entire energy use. And energy use and energy expenditure is everything we do. So when you wake up in the morning, say, you need to spend a third of your time to the development of solar power, you might say. Everything, 30% or 40% of everything that happens in society would have to be designated to the production of these energy technologies. So in that sense, and from there you can again say that if you can export or outsource certain amount of this energy requirement, the EROY goes up. So they become more and energetically favorable if other people can do this, you know. And that's what happens essentially. I'm not sure if that was too convoluted, maybe.
I think this is incredibly important stuff. So we're down to just a few minutes left, and can you sum up for us what you would like for listeners of this interview to take away? What's your point? What are you trying to say? And you can go on for a few minutes. You don't have to do it in one sentence or anything.
There are many points to make with regards to solar power.
One thing we haven't talked about is your larger analysis. You know, we've only talked about solar, which is fine if you want to stay there. But if you want to jump to a larger analysis of technology, you can do that too. Whatever you want to do is great.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how to wrap up, but wrap up. I think there are many ways I can do this, I suppose. One of the major findings or like major points that I'd like to come across that stems from another analysis as well, but that is that if we pursue solar power as societies to prevent climate change, then we should expect significant and increased social ecological problems in other parts of the Earth system. So solar power does not come from nowhere. I think that's the essential message, but it's often displayed as if it's just simply pops out of the ground. or not even that, it just pops out of thin air. And that's an illusion and an overlooked flaw in the modern cultural conception of the world. Technologies do not come from nowhere. And the same applies for a car and anything else. And solar power in particular, and renewables, if they are to sustain our current way of living, or rather, if we want to sustain our way of living through the help of renewables, it will require a massive amount of materials. I think this is a massive impact on the natural world that may even exceed the problems and the impacts of climate change, for instance. And so essentially this means that we need to seriously question industrialism, essentially, which is the dedication, the blind dedication, you might say, at least today, to mass production of commodities and mass consumption. I mean, this has to go, essentially, if we want to maintain any form of relation to the Earth and the Earth system, which is, and our relation is our survival, of course. Now, there is a power dimension in this too, which is that certain groups of people can actually maintain solar power and have solar power and renewables if they can export the impacts of them. And in that sense, large scale solar PV development and other renewables has an inherent colonial character to them. And this colonialism, of course, extends, it's not only social, but also ecological. So what we're doing when we turn to renewables is that we're not to sustain our way of living, or the way of living, not our, the industrial way of living, is that we're essentially not renewing energy, but we're renewing the domination of the natural world. And we're renewing the social power structure that has shaped the world economy, at least since the 16th century. So it's not something new. Renewables is not something new in its essence. It's a continuation of industrial capitalism that has wreaked havoc on the planet for way too long. So that's why I titled this book Renewing Power, because that's what it does. That's what it is. So I suppose that's one way to sum up. Just a final point as well, that we're often, so one question is, okay, why don't people in general make this argument? Why do we not see this? Why do people tend to not make this, come to the same conclusion, but rather think of solar power as a salvation and a way to fundamentally transform society and our nature relations? And one concept that we haven't talked about is fetishization, which is essentially an anthropological concept explaining how modern humans, in particular, that people within the industrial culture societies, tend to ascribe agency to technological artifacts in their everyday life. And think of technological artifacts, so you might have a cell phone or a computer in front of you, as an independent object, as an object that just simply exists. With a productive capacity of its own. We say in our language, it's the computer that does the work, or the phone that does the work, or the solar panel that captures the energy. But this cannot happen without these supply chains. But they are typically hidden from our view, because, for us as consumers of them, at least. So we're inhibited from understanding real impacts and the reality of technologies. We're not encouraged to think of the computer as having this very complicated past. So we just look at the solar panel, or some people just look at the solar panel and say, okay, yeah, let's install this here and it will solve issues. And the solar panel has then just appeared out of thin air. So I suppose I'll just end there, I guess.
I would like to read one sentence from your wonderful piece, and then we'll close. And the sentence is, this forces us to seriously consider to what degree a long-term sustainable relation to the biosphere can be reached through an endless expansion of the technosphere, as implied in proposals for green, in quotes, growth, or various green, in quotes, technologies, and to what degree it can only be reached by a progressive degrowth with attention to well-being, justice, and ecological limits. So I really want to thank you for that, and I want to thank you for your work in the world, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. And my guest today has been Andreas Roos. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.